The leader of ISIS was killed during a nighttime raid by U.S. special forces in Syria. But will operations like this curb the threat?
Is this foreshadowing a kind of strategy in which the U.S. is depending on intel and moving in only as necessary to go after top leaders? If that's the case, can you effectively reduce the impact and the strength of a group like ISIS with occasional raids? How frequently do they have to do them?
And why this week's tech earnings are dragging down Wall Street. Plus, what you should check for before you buy that face mask. It's Thursday, February 3rd. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. President Biden said today that Islamic State leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi was killed during a nighttime raid by U.S. special forces on a multi-story building in northwestern Syria. The president said the operation was conducted by special forces rather than with an airstrike to minimize civilian casualties.
Our team is still compiling the report, but we do know that as our troops approach to capture the terrorist, in a final act of desperate cowardice, he, with no regard to the lives of his own family or others in the building, he chose to blow himself up, not just with the vest, but to blow up that third floor, rather than face justice for the crimes he has committed, taking several members of his family with him, just as his predecessor did.
A Syrian civil defense group, the White Helmets, said emergency rescue workers who reached the scene minutes after U.S. forces had left said they recovered the bodies of 13 people, including 6 children and 4 women, from the house and surrounding area. The group said it was unclear how they died. We'll talk more about the raid and how it fits into the U.S. strategy against ISIS in just a few minutes. Facebook's parent company Meta lost more than $230 billion in market value today, the biggest ever one-day loss for a U.S. company after it said it expects changes to Apple's privacy policy to cost it more than $10 billion in lost sales this year. Other tech stocks, including PayPal and Spotify, have suffered double-digit declines in recent days. A series of disappointing earnings reports from big tech companies dragged U.S. stocks sharply lower today. The Nasdaq fell 3.7%. It was the index's worst day since September of 2020. The S&P 500 dropped 2.4%, and the Dow shed more than 500 points to end the day down 1.45%. After the bell, Amazon said its profit nearly doubled in the critical holiday season to $14.3 billion, as the company managed to control labor and supply costs better than expected and saw gains in cloud computing and advertising. Amazon has fared better than most companies during the COVID-19 pandemic, though growth has slowed more recently. Still, the company today signaled a more positive outlook than previous quarters, and shares shot up more than 17% in early after-hours trading. On Capitol Hill, President Biden's nominee to be the top banking regulator at the Federal Reserve told senators she wouldn't use the position to restrict lending to the oil and gas industry. Sarah Bloom Raskin faced skeptical questioning from Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee, citing her previous calls for more aggressive regulatory moves away from high-emissions investments. In addition to Raskin, President Biden has named two other economists for Fed board posts, Lisa Cook and Philip Jefferson. All three nominees told lawmakers that the Fed must make it a priority to tackle high inflation. Republican opposition to the nominees could make it harder for them to get confirmed in a closely divided Senate. Meanwhile, Europe's central banks are showing more concern about soaring inflation and that they're willing to raise interest rates in the hopes of bringing down higher prices. The Bank of England raised its key interest rate for a second straight meeting today to 0.5%. That follows signals from the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. that it will begin raising interest rates in mid-March. And while the European Central Bank kept rates unchanged in a press conference, President Christine Lagarde left the door open to rate hikes later this year. Coming up, is the U.S. taking a new tack in the fight against ISIS?
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
As we covered earlier, the leader of the Islamic State was killed during a nighttime raid by U.S. Special Forces in Syria. The mission eliminated a top terrorist leader in the Middle East who officials say posed a threat to America. The mission comes amid heightened geopolitical tensions, including Russia's military standoff with Ukraine. And it comes as the U.S. has fewer troops in the Middle East. So, what can the raid tell us about the U.S. approach to combating ISIS with fewer boots on the ground? For more on this, I'm joined by Wall Street Journal national security reporter Nancy Youssef. Hi, Nancy. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be with you.
Nancy, what can you tell us about the timing of this operation? This is the second major military operation the president has announced this week. The first, as we talked about in yesterday's show, was to deploy 3,000 U.S. troops to Europe in support of allies during Russia's military standoff with Ukraine. Had this overnight raid been a longtime target the U.S. was quietly monitoring in Syria, is the timing here coincidental?
So the U.S. says that it began planning for this for months and even made a model mock-up of the house for the military operators to work around and learn and get their sort of situational awareness in the run-up to this raid. But I think the timing of it is always predicated on all sorts of things, weather, other circumstances that can push an operation off by a couple of days. And in this case, in fact, our understanding is that weather was a factor and led to this raid being maybe several days later than they had initially anticipated. But as you know, there's also a political factor in all this, in that the president has been facing a lot of pressure about Ukraine, criticism about his handling the end of Afghanistan. And so today there's been a real focus on what the military is calling a successful operation.
Nancy, what can you tell us about Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Karashi, who took over after former Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi died in 2019 during a U.S.-led raid also?
Well, the interesting thing is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the founder of ISIS, was a very well-known figure. He'd given a lot of public statements, and he had taken his vision and created this self-proclaimed caliphate. Whereas his successor was not nearly as public. He hadn't made any public speeches in the time that he was in charge of the organization. The United States says that he was actively involved in operations, but we don't have much on that. I think what's interesting is that he took over at a time when ISIS appeared to be in a quite weak state. Its self-proclaimed caliphate had been destroyed. Many of its fighters and supporters were in prison, and the group had appeared to be dissipated through a series of attacks by the United States on their capital, Raqqa. And what he was able to do was keep some level of cohesion within the group. We continue to see ISIS affiliates around the world declare allegiance to him. And we even saw an expansion of ISIS in sub-Saharan Africa and in the Sahel during his tenure. But we never really saw him. That all said, I think the important thing to remember is that this is an organization that is constantly planning for the loss of its leadership. And so while the U.S. considers this a big strategic win, historically, we have seen that these terror groups have been able to bounce back from the loss of leaders and, in fact, have planned for them. Al-Qaeda went on after bin Laden. ISIS went on after Baghdadi. And so while his death will have an impact on ISIS in the short term, I think past raids and strikes suggest that these groups are able to still continue even after the loss of prominent leaders, and in this case, someone who was not nearly as, at least publicly, aggressive in his messaging to supporters.
Let's talk more about what we know about the U.S. operation. The U.S., of course, has faced questions and backlash over previous operations where there were civilian casualties. In this operation, President Biden said al-Karashi detonated explosives that killed himself and several members of his family as U.S. forces approached. What else do we know about how this operation was carried out by the U.S. and about the 13 civilian casualties, which included 6 children and 4 women?
So one important point on this raid is that the president said that it would have been logistically easier and safer for U.S. troops to have done, for example, an airstrike, but that they chose to send in troops on a raid at the site in a bid to minimize civilian casualties, because in their planning for this operation, they both knew that there were children in the residence, and they also knew that there was the possibility that the ISIS leader would use an explosive to kill himself rather than be taken captured. And the president argued that this was a much more dangerous mission, but one that was really designed to minimize civilian casualties. It's worth noting, too, that just a few weeks ago, the Pentagon said that it was going to recommit itself to minimizing civilian casualties after a RAND study found that the Pentagon's actually been quite inconsistent in how it approaches examining civilian casualties, planning operations to minimize civilian casualties. But yet we still don't know. Of course, it's very early in the operation. We don't actually know how many were killed or how they were killed. For example, some may have been killed by the explosion. There was a firefight that broke out at some point. Could they have been killed in the exchange of gunfire? Could they have been killed by other means that we haven't heard about yet? And so one of the challenges is not only the number, but also the circumstances that led to them. And so it will take several days, but I think it'll be a metric in terms of how the U.S. incorporated minimizing civilian casualties in its operations, particularly after that very damning RAND report that said that the U.S. is quite inconsistent in preventing these deaths when conducting operations.
Nancy, what does this operation tell us overall about the U.S. strategy now toward ISIS and where that strategy is focused?
So the president said that one of the things they wanted to communicate is that ISIS should know that while the U.S. has been looking at a pivot towards Asia while there's been focus on Ukraine, that if they can find leaders who are responsible for the ongoing operations of ISIS, that they would target them and that they would kill them, even at risk to U.S. troops, as the president alluded to in this mission. I think in terms of looking at ISIS going forward and the U.S. strategy towards it, this might be an interesting window that with fewer U.S. forces in the region, with more focus on Asia, and more recently, threats from Russia, I think what we have to look for going forward is this foreshadowing a kind of strategy in which the U.S. is depending on intel and moving in only as necessary to go after top leaders? If that's the case, can you effectively reduce the impact and the strength of a group like ISIS with occasional raids? How frequently do they have to do them? One should be asking, I think, for this to be an effective counter-ISIS strategy. The other thing I would note is that ISIS is not just in Syria, but in countries all over the world. And so as we think about a counter-ISIS strategy, I think it has to be in the context of these satellite groups throughout the world, most notably in Afghanistan and an expanding presence on the African continent.
Wall Street Journal national security reporter Nancy Youssef. Nancy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And finally, when it comes to finding a face mask to protect against COVID-19, health experts have long said that for most people, nothing compares to an N95 or a KN95. But it turns out not all respirator masks are created equal. The Wall Street Journal worked with safety experts to test out some commercially available N95s and found that some of them don't meet federal standards for filtration. So how can you know if the mask you're about to buy is up to snuff? Our video journalist Adam Falk says experts recommend paying attention to details, like whether it's marked as certified by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH.
So for the N95, the labeling requirements are pretty stringent in the U.S. They have to say N95, they have to have the NIOSH logo or text that says NIOSH, and they also have to have an approval number on there. It begins with T and C. And that approval number allows you to look up to see if that mask was actually approved by NIOSH. And then lastly, they have to have the manufacturer's name on there too. For KN95s, it gets a little bit trickier. They're not regulated in the US, so the Chinese standard says that KN95 masks should say KN95. They should say GB2626-2006 or 2019, and that's just the standard. And then they should say the manufacturer's name on there.
You can watch the video of how we tested out the masks and learn more at WSJ.com. And that's what's news for this Thursday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal.